Mrs. Johnson here. Can somebody tell us about her adventure?
Yes.
The plaintiff's mother was in the defendant's hospital when another person of the same name died. The plaintiff's aunt was informed that her mother had died, and that her, well, the aunt was informed that her sister had died, and the daughter, upon finding it, incurred expenses in preparing for the funeral. Upon their, I guess, their second viewing of the body, they realized that it wasn't their mother, and the hospital acknowledged its negligence and violated the same procedures, and the plaintiff thereafter suffered great mental distress, excessive anxiety, and was able to, unable to concentrate and work.
Okay, so the defendant acknowledges the responsibility to pay for the property damage, so the expense of going to make these arrangements and all that sort of thing. They're willing to reimburse, but they say, in effect, this case falls within the general rule that in the absence of physical injury, you can't recover for mere emotional harm. So again, without physical injury, that's our general rule. But as we've seen, rules were made to be broken. Rules sort of provoke this. Well, is that always the case? Well, not necessarily. As the plaintiff argues for an exception to be made in this case, the plaintiff can draw on some previous examples where the courts hadn't strictly followed this rule, such as?
There's two kinds of exceptions. First is if the telegram company delays the message of the transmission of the telegram announcing the death of someone. And the second exception is the negligent handling of the corpse.
So if you're the undertaker, the funeral home, and you're hauling, I'm trying to remember some movie in which the casket slides out of the hearse and dumps the body on the pavement. Well, yeah, that falls into the negligent mishandling of a corpse. Even though there's no physical injury to the plaintiffs, the loved ones of the decedent who see this happen can recover for their emotional harm. Similarly, if a telegraph company, you pay your money to send a telegram, regret to inform you, father passed away, funeral on Tuesday, and that telegram would allow the person to get to the funeral before their loved one was buried. If you negligently do that, you can't recover. Now, why do these exceptions not cover our case?
Well, I mean, neither of those things actually occurred.
At least not to this plaintiff. With respect to the other the real Mrs. Johnson's family, where there was, the mishandling of her body without notification to the family, and, I don't know if it would constitute negligent transmission of the, but there's going to be some claim for them. But as to the Mrs. Johnson, who's still alive, living in this state hospital, as to her family, the defendants say, no harm, no foul. What does the court wind up doing? What do they think?
The trial court rules in favor of the defendant, and then the plaintiff appeals.
Okay. And what's the plaintiff's argument on appeal, or what does the court wind up making of this case?
Well, the court says that the hospital owed a duty to the plaintiff to refrain from such conduct, and that...
Let's pause there for just one second to kind of absorb that. Notice here again, we're hearing phrases reminiscent of Paul's graph, reminiscent of chapter one. Did the defendant owe a duty to the plaintiff? We're figuring out the sort of boundaries of tort liability. Should we expand the boundaries of tort liability to include cases like this? Should we keep the boundaries where they are, lest we get on that toboggan and hurtle down the slippery slope? Now, if you've read further, quite a bit further actually, you eventually come to a case called Dillon versus Legg, in which the court directly addresses the whole argument based on a lack of duty of care. And the court's answer, I sometimes put it in the form of duty schmooty, what's all this business about duty of care? After all, we're the ones that make up the rules. We decide whether somebody's going to have to pay for an accident or not, so don't give us this language about duty of care that doesn't tell us anything. The real question is, do the relatives of this Mrs. Johnson, the live Mrs. Johnson, the daughter in particular, does she deserve to recover on these facts? And the court's answer, this court's answer to that question?
Yes,
she does deserve to recover. Now, according to what rule? If the rule we used to have looked like this, with a couple of exceptions that don't apply to this case, what's our new rule? Can we articulate a rule that we can expect the court to follow in future cases? Mr. Nelson?
Didn't they refer to the orbit of danger and the orbit of duty?
Well, who is it? Our old friend Cardozo there. Again, shades of this, you know, big sort of philosophical question about who decides these things and what's the general scope of liability. But if we just, leaving aside sort of the philosophy of it, we're trying to figure out what do you have to show to get past this barrier that's been put up that says, in effect, the only people allowed past this barrier are people who have a physical injury or people who fit into these two narrow exceptions. Ms. Berhoff?
Can't you show that there was a genuine emotional harm? That you have to be able to prove that there was something genuine about
it. There's another G word that they use.
Guarantee.
Guarantee of genuineness. Now, when Mrs. Spade tells us the story, I'm sitting in the train, and I'm coming home, these two drunk guys, I have no idea what these guys are going to do. They jostle with each other, one of them falls on me, I completely lost it. We don't necessarily think, oh, what a line, you know. We may believe her, but that experience is not one where you would say, oh my gosh, it sounds like a relatively ordinary experience. On the other hand, if you're having lunch with your friend and you say, you know, I got a telegram last week saying my mother had died, I go there, it's the second time I look into the casket and I say, that's not my mother. And the funeral director, well, you know, the first step of grief is denial. But then it turned out it really wasn't my mother. And so the, you know, the other person says, yeah, you know, and I went to the cleaners last week, and, you know, they, I mean, this isn't like an ordinary day, everyday experience. When we speak of something having a guarantee of genuineness, we mean something where you describe the facts of what happened, and your reaction is, oh my goodness. Wow. It has this sort of startling traumatic effect. Now we can identify a limited set of cases where we will say, you know, ordinarily we don't do this, but in your case we'll make an exception. Mr. Glover.
How did it work in this case? It kind of seemed like she had some physical manifestations. Afterward,
okay.
Does that play into it?
Now, you raise a very good question, which is, what is the difference between a physical injury and the physical manifestation of emotional harm? If I have a terrible disagreement with my wife over finances, or over whether her brother-in-law is, or whether her brother is going to come and live with us, I can show up the next day and my colleagues look at me and they say, what happened? You look terrible. I may have a physical manifestation of emotional injury, but that's not a physical injury. But at what point does a physical manifestation become a physical injury? Suppose I'm a diabetic. I have very delicate, you know, insulin balance, sugar level things, where if those get out of whack, I'm in deep trouble. And because it's emotionally related, my emotional harm causes my insulin balance to go way out of whack. Suppose I have hypertension, blood pressure, very stressful situation, knocks my blood pressure into the next level. Is that a physical injury? Hard to tell. Suppose I have a weight issue, excessive weight a restrictive weight issue. And because of emotional distress, I'm pushed away from being in balance to being out of balance. Is that a physical injury? So, if you view this relatively tolerantly or generously, the fact that she suffers these physical manifestations, sleeplessness, looks like hell. Is that a physical injury? You could say so, but you might say, no, physical injury is stuff like a cut or a bruise or whatever, and merely manifestations of underlying emotional injury. Weight gain, weight loss, increase in blood pressure, sleeplessness, etc. That's not a physical injury. Hair turns gray. It's not a physical injury. So, again, I don't really know the answer to that question. Obviously, if you're the plaintiff and you're trying to get in under the wire here, you're going to try to qualify these physical manifestations as a physical injury. Whereas if you're the defendant, you're going to say, no, that's just a manifestation. It's not really an injury. Okay, so again, what the court does in Johnson versus the State of New York is to say, yes, it's true. Our ordinary rule is physical injury is the ticket to ride this train. Without that ticket, you don't get on board. Well, yeah, we make an exception over here for these particular kinds of cases, and then we've got the more general exception to say something that is so dramatic that it's got a guarantee of genuineness. You simply describe the facts of the case. You don't have to go any further. You know that the person involved in that case is going to suffer significant emotional harm. Whereas, again, the lady on the train, you describe the facts. She gets on the train, but the drunk people are pushing and shoving, and she's bumped and it doesn't immediately trigger the kind of reaction that would suggest that she's, of course, traumatized. I want to put a little footnote here, stick a little asterisk here for the discussion later on. I mentioned the case of Dillon versus Legg. The facts of Dillon versus Legg are the mother is standing on her front porch. Her two daughters are crossing the street, and a negligent driver hits one of them in the crosswalk and kills one of the daughters. And the case is the legal issue of, in addition to the wrongful death claim, is the sister entitled to a recovery as a bystander, and or is the mother entitled to a recovery as a bystander. Now, the reason I want to kind of make note of these is the difference in the setup of the case. In Johnson versus State of New York, she's not a bystander. It's not a physical injury to somebody else to whom she is related. We'll take up all those related party issues when we get to that section of Chapter 3. What we have now is, in effect, a direct injury from the defendant to the plaintiff, but it's just emotional. It's not what I would call a derivative, or less politely called, a parasitic claim. A better term would be a derivative claim. Parasitic's a little more memorable. The notion is, I don't exist on my own, I exist because of something else. So the bystander claims we pick up in the middle section have to do with terrible injury to one person, other people standing around or related to the victim want a recovery too. The reason we deal first with these questions is what happens if there is no, derivative claim, it's just the injury to the plaintiff. Or in the case we look at later on, or I think it's in the notes here, it's after Steinhauser, actually, Moline versus Kaiser Foundation Hospital on page 21, which involves a misdiagnosis of syphilis. Blood tests are done for the patient, clinic or HMO. Kaiser was one of the first HMOs. They return the blood test and say, oh, by the way, you have syphilis. You should tell your wife. And as you might imagine, quite a significant emotional injury occurs because of this misdiagnosis. Do we say, just move on, hey, no harm, no foul? Or do we say, no, this is like Johnson versus State of New York. You've suffered the kind of injury where, even though you haven't been physically harmed, you deserve a recovery for that emotional harm that you've been put through. Yeah?
Did you say that Dillon v. Legg and Johnson are parasitic claims?
No, they're not. I'm saying Dillon versus Legg is a parasitic claim. That's why it's in the middle section. It's a related party issue. If you hurt one person, but you've got other people standing around, who else gets to recover? Here we're talking about what's the threshold of any recovery at all. So the defendant wants to say, everybody just go away. In the middle section, in the parasitic or derivative claims, the defendant says, well, of course I have to pay for this person, but not for all the other people standing around watching. And the question is, under what circumstances do you or do you not have to pay? Mr. Ortiz.
They want to say later on that you recover with proven harmful consequences. So what are you going to have to prove? Is it just the circumstances around the actual incident to get the guarantee of genuineness? or is it a combination of that and the, you know, emotional distress?
Well, to some extent, this issue is addressed in the later section where the Washington court's looking at these cases, trying to fit them all together. They wind up giving us the principle there have to be, I think they refer to as objective medical symptoms. Now, again, that's not a very fixed term. You know, if you're a plaintiff and you're put into the personal injury mill, and we've got, you know, experts on our Rolodex who are adept at putting emotional harm into objective medical terminology. Oh, you have a type 4, you know, blah, 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 blah. It's straight out of the, you know, diagnostic and statistical manual that mental health professionals use, DSM-4. And yeah, here's the classification for your situation. So saying it has to have objective medical, you know, symptoms is not much of a threshold. What it does say is I can't simply come and say, I'm upset, I'm really upset. That doesn't cut it. But if I go to a counselor and the counselor says, yeah, they're suffering from whatever it is, and they've got a label for it, well, I guess that's an objective medical symptom. Now, again, I don't need to do that if I've got a physical injury. If I've got a bruise or a cut, I don't need psychiatrists or psychologists to classify and diagnose it. I can say, I got up every morning and I hurt. Or, I just can't, you know, I used to be the clutch hitter on my Jack and Jill softball team, and, you know, now I just can't hit the curveball anymore. And I want, you know, damages for that. And the jury can give you damages for that if you've suffered a physical injury. But if you haven't suffered a physical injury and you're trying to get in under one of these, you know, guarantee of genuineness kind of claims, you got to produce this sort of resume of official medical diagnosis to say, yeah, this person has a post-traumatic stress disorder, you know, blah, 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 blah. Ms. Zagajewski?
Yeah. I'm wondering about the gross carelessness, and it says it's that hospital active gross carelessness. And isn't that also an exception, so you don't have to show a physical injury? So you have to show a guarantee of genuineness accompanying the class, or would that be enough?
It's a little harder to identify the difference between gross negligence. There's some kinds of claims where gross negligence is the threshold. But there aren't very many cases like that where you get a different standard. Going back to the Morse case, is where you have some intentional or quasi-intentional harm. That is, if I set out to harm you, it's an intentional injury, or if I'm reckless, that may satisfy some other kinds of standards. But in a lot of these cases, you don't have gross. I mean, the confusion between the two Emma Johnsons, regrettable, but it's not, you know, oh, how could you possibly have done that? You're working at a busy hospital, say, hey, Mrs. Johnson, Mrs. Emma Johnson. And you're going through the files and, you know, you type in Emma Johnson and on the screen and it pops up and, yeah, you know, these things happen. So in that respect, it's not so much that what the hospital did was, or same thing in Moline. You know, you're running 1,000 blood tests a day and you're just about to put the label on this test tube or whatever it is, this little vial of blood, and the phone rings or, you know, something happens and you turn around and, you know, you go back to putting the labels on these things and you get them mixed up. It happens. So the question is, again, assuming we've got a case of ordinary negligence as we would describe it in Chapter 1, what happens if the form of damage suffered by the plaintiff is not a physical injury, but instead is this mere emotional harm. And the courts struggle with, on the one hand, trying to compensate those cases that truly deserve compensation, at the same time avoiding this overextension of the system such that people are suing each other right and left for the sorts of emotional distress we cause one another because we're not thinking clearly at times. Okay. I would say the general rule is more like this. Yeah. This one sort of swallows up the other, and this happens to be, you know, the rule in New York where they'd recognize these claims. It's much harder, as we'll see, when in the middle of the chapter we look at the Washington cases following up on Dillon versus Legg, the bystander injury cases, and the court tries to come up with some more general rule. Different states have different variations on the theme and different precedent cases, and it's often very difficult to figure out exactly where your case lines up in the magnitude of the emotional injury and how fussy the court will be about having medical symptomology or some kind of objective signs. Again, the courts are struggling on the one hand to give awards where they are deserved, but to try to reduce the number of sort of frivolous lawsuits that are out there. Okay, so again, Johnson versus State of New York gives you this concept here that we have a rule, but we have an exception to the rule. Exactly how it's phrased, I use this. I like the term guarantee of genuineness because it's sort of kind of a nice middle standard that in some form or other each jurisdiction is going to use. It's going to pick out its exceptions, but it may have restrictive rules that say it only applies here, it only applies there, and it does apply here, but it doesn't apply there. As I said, trying to thread the needle between having an overly restrictive rule and having an overly generous rule. Let's look at Steinhauser as our last of this little series. Raises a slightly different issue on how we approach these kinds of cases. Can somebody tell us about Cynthia Steinhauser? Mr. Glover.
The plaintiff was driving the car with her parents when they were struck by another motorist. At first blush, it appeared that everybody was okay. It was just a minor accident. And then after a few minutes, the plaintiff, or the girl in this case, she started acting strangely, said that she had a glassy eye, upset, agitated. And then her situation grew worse, and she started to have psychotic bouts. She was later diagnosed with schizophrenic reaction. That's acute and undifferentiated.
Okay, she's hospitalized. If you've seen the movie Girl Interrupted, life in a psychiatric hospital is no fun. And one of the things about this case, of course, that we know is that she's not faking this. No one in their right mind, no matter how much they wanted tort compensation, I don't think anybody would put themselves through what she went through in the phase of being hospitalized and so forth. Okay, so the question, what's the question before the House here? What do we need to decide about Cynthia? Okay, what's the defendant's argument?
I think he kind of claims that she already had it. I mean, he shows some evidence that she had been bucked off a horse before and maybe had this history of it. So
Yeah, and I don't know what the latest thinking is about schizophrenia. There's sort of the long-running issue in psychiatry about the relative role of physical things, genetics, brain chemistry, and the role of incidents or sort of psychological history, relationship issues. For example, in the treatment of autism, there was a guy named Bruno Bettelheim, classic Freudian psychiatrist who had all these theories about, you know, why children become autistic, all based upon interaction, you know, relationship with parents and so forth and so on. Then the latest theory about autism is that it's all brain chemistry. It has nothing to do with relationships, you know, whether you had a cold or distant, you know, parent or this. It all has to do with, you know, the relative ratios of different kinds of chemicals in your brain. Same thing with schizophrenia. You know, schizophrenia is sort of an emotional disorder, or whether it's simply, gee, when these little delicately balanced chemicals get twisted over in this direction. So to treat schizophrenia, we don't have people lie on a couch and, you know, talk about their childhood. We simply start feeding them different, whatever the SSRIs, something serotonin reuptake something or other, where we, you know, Paxil and Prozac and whatever the other, Zoloft and all these other drugs are, to try to get people's brain chemistry in a more normal range. Whatever was going on with Cynthia, it didn't start with this accident. As it were, kind of, you know, using our Excel spreadsheet here, chart making function, Cynthia's mental health, you know, index was kind of on the downward slope. And then along comes this automobile accident, and she suddenly plunges below the level of functionality and has to be hospitalized. So the defendant's argument is, in effect, we didn't start this. She was headed for this one way or the other. She's 14 years old. Far more traumatic events lay in her future aside from this automobile accident. And something else would have triggered it. The defendant has another argument about why they don't want to have to pay for Cynthia Steinhauser's hospitalization, all the effects of her schizophrenic condition. Why else shouldn't they have to pay, or why would it be inappropriate for the jury to make an award in a case like this? They have absolutely no idea what they're talking about. That is, there's no way that you could pinpoint, okay, she was going to have 3.6 months of normalcy beyond this point, and then we're all just sort of speculating. Now, the court uses this non-gender neutral language here. At the very end of the opinion, they say, you know, however taxing such a problem may be for men who have devoted their lives to psychiatry. In other words, psychiatrists can't agree on this. There's no medical diagnosis. But then the court says this odd thing. However taxing it might have been for people who devote their lives to this, it's one for which a jury is ideally suited. Is this irony, sarcasm? Anybody have a sense of what's going on here? Mr. Anderson?
Well, I think it goes back to the whole issue of when the jury hears from all the different experts, it comes down to a jury of reasonable minds to kind of determine what the best idea is out of the experts.
Same way they figure out the weight loss claim for a 15-year-old with mild brain damage. You know, was this kid going to be a highly successful architect based on what we saw of his character and his skills and so forth? Or was he going to be like his older brother, in and out of, low-wage jobs and, basically likes to play with his cars and play paintball on the weekends and not much there in the way of wage law. The jury's got to figure that out. So in the same way, the jury has to figure out what they're going to do with this conflicting psychiatric testimony. Cynthia was a mess before she got into this car, and 2 days in junior high school at the age of 14 are far more traumatic than any automobile accident. So blaming her schizophrenia on an automobile accident is ridiculous, versus the psychiatrist who said, no, this is precisely the kind of trauma that makes her afraid of dying, and this triggered all this other kind of stuff. Suddenly she starts hearing voices, and she has this classic kind of dissociative mental experience. And the jury has to take this expert testimony and do what they can with it. So, again, the role of the jury the court is essentially saying some problems are so difficult, we have to give them to, when the psychiatrists with their 20 years of experience in clinical training and graduating from the best medical schools and having residencies here and special, postdocs, this, that, and the other, research fellowships, et cetera, they can't agree. So we get, a tire mechanic and a retired school teacher and a gardener and a pizza place cook. These are the people we put on the jury. We say, well, what do you all think? And when they give us an answer, we say, good, we'll go with it. Now, it sort of creates the clash, the kind of culture clash between the plaintiff's bar, which emphasizes the sort of genius of this system. The classic Greek story of going to the Oracle of Delphi. You have these difficult questions, and so you go to the Oracle and you get this message or answer to your questions. We sort of expect the jury to have a similar sort of oracular power. We got these terrible problems, we don't know how to solve them, so we go to the juries. From the standpoint of the defense, the manufacturers and doctors and institutions and the people who are on the paying end of this stuff, they go absolutely berserk. They say this is the nuttiest system anybody ever devised. This is not a jury of, if I'm a cardiologist, it is not a jury of my peers who will decide whether I've committed malpractice. It's that brake mechanic and the part-time cook at Pizza Pipeline who's going to decide whether I'm a good doctor or not. I just cannot fathom this. So, whether it's the best of times, the worst of times, whether this is a great system or just an absolutely nutty system, is still very much up for grabs, in part depending on where you sit. Are you the beneficiary of this, or are you on the losing end of this? What should we think of it? Mr. Gallagher.
Is it not possible that the court wants to resort to the jury here because ultimately the goal is some form of a general consensus, whereas you have too many experts and specialists in the field debating, they can all find something to fixate on. They have their pet theory, for example.
Sure. Well, the whole notion of war is too important to be left to the generals. That you know, democracy is the worst of all possible forms of government except for all the others. That, you know, democracy works not because when you put things to a vote, you get the right answer. That the virtue of democracy is that it's sort of self-correcting. That is, as we drift over into being overly generous toward plaintiffs and everybody's lining up to get a free, you know, shot at the lottery, then presumably the 12 people whose insurance rates have gone up and who, you know, whose public parks have been closed because they can't pay the liability insurance anymore, and you can't play in the park because, well, we got sued over that the last time, so we're closing it all. So presumably those jurors who sit on the juries now are going to correct for that by being very tough in looking at plaintiffs and being, so plaintiffs' lawyers complain about how hostile juries are in looking at their clients as though they were all just liars and swindlers and everybody's singing the blues here about how tough it is. So the theory of the jury system, again, is that as you kind of get people from the community cycling in and out, today I'm a party, tomorrow I'm on the jury, you get a more balanced, connected feeling. Whereas if we had this system that the defense bar suggests, give it to the experts, then you get this division, this disaffection between the professionals who operate this system. It's one of the criticisms of workers' comp, for example. Workers' comp is in the hands of these bureaucrats, you know, with the green eye shades, you know, looking over their shoulder at the rates. They don't care about these people in front of them. They're inured to any sort of human feeling. It's just a job. Whereas if I get a jury of 12 people, they'll look at my situation with fresh eyes. And again, the defense perspective on that is what you really mean is 12 new people to scam. That the good plaintiff's lawyer can manipulate those 12 people in a way that once they've seen what the game is, wow, you know, then they realize how they've been had. But the first time around, sitting on a jury, it sounds pretty good to them, and they'll buy. And that's all I need as a plaintiff's lawyer to get what I want and move on. So, again, this kind of clash between the perspectives of whether the jury system is this great system working, you know, to keep us all sort of on track, or whether the jury system is this insane kind of lottery. Again, it's the continuing sort of debate about that, about the system. Okay, so again, emotional injuries are often the big ticket item in a case. Physical injury, medical expenses, wage loss, they're significant, but if I've got a 15-year-old with mild brain damage, and I'm going to present that to the jury and ask the jury to compensate that 15-year-old, I'm not going to talk about the discounted value of an income stream projected into the year 2020, affected by the rising rates in gross domestic product. That's not what I'm going to talk to the jury about. I'm going to talk about the compensation for the relationships that he starts that he can't finish. And there will not be a dry eye in that room when I'm done. That's the way I'm going to get the jury to make a generous award. And again, from the defendant's standpoint, it isn't fair. I can't match that. I can't tell you all the sad things about my defendant client and how this award is going to break them. I probably represent an insurance company, or, you know, I can't match the firepower what the plaintiff's going to do in an emotionally And virtually every case, if you do it right, even if you have a person with a mixed background, a person who's not perfect, well, in the right hands, the jury's going to identify even more so with this person, like themselves, who had a future, but that future has gone away because, you know, of this thing that happened to them. What's that worth, ladies and gentlemen? So this is where the action is in terms of the tort system. And if you like it or you don't like it, you have to sort of ask yourself the question, okay, what ought the rules to be? How do we want juries to make these awards if you like the system or if you don't like this? I suspect the challenge is much greater if you don't like the system. If your instincts are more toward the defense and you are troubled by the way in which this personal injury system does have a kind of slimy quality to it, manipulative, emotionally overreaching. If you don't like it, what are you going to do about it? Are you going to make arbitrary limits to say, well, the emotional damages can never be more than this multiple of the economic loss? That's one way to do it. Are you going to do it by saying there's an absolute cap to emotional damages? Are you going to do it in some other kind of, by what technique can you make the awards made by juries correspond to something that you think is a better approximation of a fair result? I will now get on my soapbox, if I haven't been there already, speaking personally, editorially, what I would do if I were czar. I would do something with the jury system. I can say that because I'd have to be czar. I can never do this democratically. I cannot get people to vote themselves off the jury system. Or, you know, maybe it's like Ulysses tying himself to the mast, saying, yes, I want to listen to that. But I want to listen to the sirens, but I want to be restrained from being able to do anything about it because I know if I'm able to do what I feel like doing, it will be to my destruction. In fact, there's a story, I think it's historically reliable. Benjamin Franklin, who was, not terribly fastidious about certain things. He was a rake and a womanizer, but he liked to go hear the missionaries give their evangelical testimony. He thought it was great theater, and I think he believed. You know, Benjamin Franklin made this speech in the Constitutional Convention when they were hopelessly deadlocked, and Franklin says the reason we're in this pickle is because we haven't begun our sessions with prayer. And so he makes this, Franklin's a very interesting character. But it's said that he would, he'd go to these, presentations, take all of his jewelry off, and put all his valuables, put $5, £5, whatever the currency was, go to these things and listen to them, and he knew when he was there, they would present this, very appealing, heart-wrenching thing, and he'd want to give them all the money he had. And he didn't want to have, they say of constitutions that a constitution is the rules Philip Sober makes for Philip Drunk. The relationship there, like Ulysses tying himself to the mast, that essentially you put me on a jury and have someone present the facts of the case, I'm going to want to give the money to this person, not just because I feel sorry for them, but because it's a way of making things right. In all the areas in life where you'd like to do something to make things right and you can't, suddenly you're on the jury and it does seem like you can make things right. Here's a wrong committed by the defendant. Here's this suffering plaintiff. You can give them, you know, here's this 15-year-old with brain damage. You don't want to simply say, ah. You want to make it right. But again, being on my soapbox here, it's that very problem. Unless you had a rule that said, in effect, juries have to be restrained, have to restrain themselves, I don't like any of the artificial caps or formulas or anything else. There's arbitrarily bad. They're not the problem. The problem is that we're not in our right mind. But it's sort of a question, when are we in our right mind? It's sort of like Franklin. When was Franklin in his right mind? When he was taking all his, you know, valuables off and leaving them, was he in his right mind then, knowing later on I'll not be in my right mind? Or is he actually in his right mind when the missionaries are telling him, you know, here's all the good I could do with, just take that, you know, ring that you have, or that, you know, fancy whatever it is that you have, and here's what I could do with it. Oh, gee, now that you put it that way, well, what am I going to do with it? Look at it, you know, impress my friends with it. Whereas I could feed these people or save their souls or do something else of, you know, much greater value. So when am I in my right mind? Similarly, in the tort system, the legislator who's listening to the business groups telling them about rising premiums and the cost of this and the cost of that, and I say, gee, we need to do this, that, and the other thing, I don't have that 15-year-old with brain damage walking in and out of the courtroom every day that I look at, I begin to identify with, I hear the story of his life. I hear the efforts he made, you know, when he was 13 and 14. And now this thing happened and it's all gone. You know, when am I in my right mind? The cold legislator, you know, trying to keep the economy on track, or that person listening sympathetically, one human being to another? So this again is talking about schizophrenia. Welcome to the world of schizophrenia, where we're just, you know, divided in this in our thinking. And so again, the tort system kind of struggles through trying to balance these competing considerations and come up with reasonably workable rules. Okay, we'll quit there for the day. We'll pick up with punitive damages tomorrow. Obviously, we have our Q&A session. I'll take a little 10-minute break, and we'll come back.